Your mind's been fairly expanded here by the entire Columbia and its associative experiences with these composers. So,
something's happened to it.
Is there something that you decide that you want to do with all this?
Well, I have a secret life as a composer. So, for instance, okay. Like going back in time, here was an idea that I had and that I worked with on some pieces, and the idea was, in tonal music, when we get into the music of Richard Strauss and we get in this period of music where the chromaticism is getting to be very extreme, so like Elektra, right, and Salome,
mm-hmm.
and I remember she was working on Elektra, and she was working on this passage, and I took a look at it, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. It's all, like, you would have a passage, you know, like how Giant Steps uses the augmented chord to delineate the key areas?
Mm-hmm.
And so, in the Elektra, I think it's Elektra, I'm not good with repertoire and facts, bother me, as much as I pretend to be good at them by denouncing fiction, but where there's all the modulations, like in a given area, occur, like, say, so it's all in one part, it's going D and it's modulating quickly to B flat and F sharp and D and B flat and F sharp and D, and then it changes to an area where it's modulating between C sharp and A and F and C sharp.
Mm-hmm.
But in each of these. And I look at these, and Schoenberg talks about regions, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so there's an area of the piece that's in, instead of, he talks about modulation to another region, mm-hmm. right? So you might go to the dominant region.
Mm-hmm.
And so I looked at these, and I said, oh, these are like hyper-regions. Because the consistent use of a modulatory device, but then the consistent use of that modulatory device creates a new kind of hyper-tonality. That is all the keys that are related by the augmented chord,
mm-hmm.
right? And so then your one key is D, B flat, F sharp, D, and your other key is C sharp, A, F, C sharp, and your other key is the C, G sharp, E, C, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so those guys then become the contrasting things, like you big deal when you move from one of those to another.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came up with this idea of hyper regions. But then I was messing around with my 12-tone composing, and I'm doing this stuff with combinatorial pairs, and I came to look upon, and I would look at them, and I would notice similar kinds of relationships occur. So if I have one combinatorial pair, then the combinatorial pair that's a major third above that is going to have the displacements of the functions from the one set of rows to the other, to this other pair of rows that's a major third away, is going to be the same kind of displacement of functions that's going to occur if you then do the other major third on top of the secondary pair,
mm-hmm.
right? And so then I got the idea of using these as sort of hyper-regions in a 12-tone piece of music, and so I was developing this language out of these complex procedures of motion. So I might have an area of the piece where I'm stating row forms and moving by major third through combinatorial pairs, or I might have another area where I'm moving by major second through combinatorial pairs, and the functions, the way that the individual pitches change function from one pair to another change depending on what kind of interval cycle you're using. Mm-hmm. Right, you're familiar with the interval cycle thing from having dealt with the Pearl and stuff.
Yeah, and I've read all of Schoenberg and stuff like
that. So, then I've got this toy, which mm-hmm. is this sort of mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And so, then I compose pieces with that
mm-hmm.
for a while. And it's funny because, and this then is a beautiful rounding off of the whole thing. So I go to Pat Carpenter, years after having studied with her, and I don't know if this was on the same trip when we went and visited her with Jacques, but and she's asking me what I'm doing, and I describe this whole thing. the whole, like I just described to you, this very complex idea of the hyperregions and stuff. And she looks at me and she says, "You shouldn't be talking like that." And here I am, and I'm like, oh my God, this is the person who taught me to talk like this. Uh-huh. You know, my complete, and I'm like, okay, so what, how do you think I should be talking? She says, "I don't know, you should be talking about energies or something." And I was kind of like, okay. Okay, so yet another one of these Zen koans. Like, I spent like 10 years on Can the Peace Be True? Now I've kind of like worked this one out. Uh-huh. And then I kind of came to the understanding that, yeah, she meant that ultimately, if you create one of these things, it has a certain sound and feeling.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately more real than the language that you use for it.
Yeah.
Or something. And so she was sort of intending that I should be more, less concerned with this intellectual artifice of the thing, that I should be concerned for the actual way that it feels.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes sense in terms of like Schoenberg, because Schoenberg would talk about, you know, it's not enough to have just the theoretical framework. You have to be able to create a dramatic presentation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all opera, and it has to ultimately have this, it has to have drama and stuff.
Yeah. And reason. An idea indicates a reason. Now, yeah. Let me ask a question. You teach a lot of people. We got pedagogy. You teach a lot of people. It occurs to me that your time at Columbia, they thought that you needed to know blah, such and such. If you didn't, then you had no business being there.
Yeah. Well, I just remember, they, you know, when I got into trouble for taking the too many points in music,
mm-hmm.
I was got called into the chairman's office,
mm-hmm.
Ernie Saunders, very wonderful man, great mm-hmm. musician, great musicologist, a person for whom I have nothing but kind things to say and respect, mm-hmm. and he said, "Well, you know, we're not really in the business of training composers here. That's what they do down at Juilliard."
Uh-huh.
I don't think he really thought that it was appropriate for a composer to have all this history.
Uh-huh.
And stuff that I was getting. I think that he thought, you know, composers are supposed to go to Juilliard and become fantastic score readers and pianists and then do whatever they do.
It was a technical knowledge, but that's
right. But they were looking to train musicologists.
What seems so strange about that is that it seems in direct contradiction to the most high powered people you had over there, who were Pat Carpenter and Jacques Rubino.
Yeah.
Didn't think that at all.
I think they thought that
if a composer didn't know this stuff, then they had no reason to compose anything. Sounds like.
I think that they thought that you know, Schoenberg talked about the sleepwalkers.
Mm.
And they, you know, the sleepwalkers being the people who can work the style but don't understand what's going on with it at a sort of deeper level.
Yeah, they don't understand why.
And
I mean, Schoenberg's criticisms can be scathing, even of his fellow Viennese that were really high powered. I mean, Rieger and all those people.
Yeah, and so I think that their idea was that one should be more than just a sleepwalker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that for Minot, I think that, you know, it's like composing a piece. It's something he said. He says, for instance, that he'll only do it when he has an idea.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, the idea of like writing on commission and stuff, it's not, he has no interest in that.
Quite frankly, at a bottom feeder level, I can totally relate. I don't really bother.
He used to have the idea of having a commission to pay people to not compose.
That's a great idea. Don't write. Yeah, it's like the take some time off, man. Like, you know, get off the force. Get your gun and your back.
Better yet, I think it would be the commission to have him destroy a piece.
Yeah. We're not taking you off the case, but give me your gun and badge and go to Florida.
Or we're going to give you this commission to burn that opera.
Yeah.
So that it will never be heard again.
But the interesting thing to me is, you know, I studied with you for a long time, and I know you have students, and quite, it became clear to me after a little while, it took about 6 months to realize that, wait a minute, you teach all of these students, it's something completely different. Like, I'd be like, you would come in and tell me, like, well, I got this kid, he's writing this thing like Chopin. I mean, you never asked me to write anything in the style of Chopin. Didn't come up. Not once. Yeah, we looked at plenty of Chopin. I mean, later. Yeah, well,
my concern with composition students, different people are equipped with different kinds of minds and different kinds of talents and different kinds of interests. And I never thought of it as being my business as a composition teacher to be in the business of being part of the music police.
But the people that you learned from were.
Absolutely were.
And you said that yourself a little while ago that pedagogy is
the way that I was trained. I was trained as a gatekeeper, mm-hmm. you know, to hold and guard the gate and not let the masses through. The problem is that I was taking the tickets for Woodstock.
Right.
You know, and at a certain point, you just give up on taking the tickets and go to the concert.
Gotcha. That is a beautiful analogy.
You know, I mean, it's like, here I am, they're telling me that I'm supposed to do all this stuff, and then I'm looking at the composers who are being performed by the symphonies, and I know about the world of rock music, and, you know, and pop music, and jazz, and all these other sorts of things, and I'm like, well, the gates are down. There's no hope at reconstructing the gates. It's just not going to happen. There probably never were any gates to begin with.
Uh-huh.
So what's the best I can do in this situation is this person comes into my house, and I try to help them.
Uh-huh.
And helping them means helping them to realize their fantasies.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I often start with the question, what is your greatest musical fantasy about what you could achieve? And let's start talking about how we go about doing that.
Really?
Yeah, whatever it is, you know. Yeah. And if it involves some other, in some cases it involves I have to become, or actually I usually manage to avoid actually becoming knowledgeable, but I will point the student in the direction of becoming extremely knowledgeable. So I've had some students who, for instance, were from Latin cultures and wanted to do, you know, Cuban music. And so I point them in the direction of some materials about that, and then they run off and learn everything about, you know, composing in that style. And I look over their stuff and pat them on the back and tell them to go write more. And encourage them and try to help them out with the voice leading and technical problems that might arise. You know, but I'm not going to tell them, I'm not going to force them to write 12-tone music, or even, you know, all tonal music. I mean, like pantonal music or anything like that, because I've had horrible experiences with trying to get students. It's like this. Teaching ear training. Hmm. And I'm teaching ear training at Texas, North Texas. And I have students in the class, and they're really bad. And, you know, I finally started joking, well, let's just use movable duh.
Duh.
Every note has the same name. It's duh.
Duh.
You know, duh, 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 duh. You know.
Super movable.
And it's kind of, they're terrible. They're terrible. And then one day I'm walking by a practice room, and I hear a kid, and he's scatting for the other guys in the practice room, like the head to confirmation at tempo, gorgeously. You know, and I'm like, and I pound on the door, and I'm like, what the fuck? Like, you come into my classroom, and you're like, da 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 da. You know, and you can't sight sing any of this stuff, but I come in here and you're scat singing confirmation and your pitch is perfect and the time is amazing and you're doing it a million miles. What's going on? And then I realize what's going on. It's not, when I get them in the classroom and I'm trying to get them to sight sing, that's not music.
Hmm.
That's yoga or something. You know what it's like to teach beginning yoga people,
wow,
right?
Yeah,
you know, so it's like you're trying to teach them yoga, and they're just like completely foreign to them. they're used to, like, athletics meaning, like, basketball or something, or calisthenics, and you're trying to get them to actually become aware of their body, and it's not exercise, and they like, retrain their whole thing. Mm-hmm. And so here I have these students, and they're coming in to do sight singing, and it's fundamentally not music to them. Mm-hmm. And so because they can't feel it, they can't sing it. Well, and I find the same thing with composing. The students come in, and if I try to get them to compose something that they can't feel, then we're going to get nowhere. Mm-hmm. I have to get them into some realm where the music and the notes take over and start to sing to them, and it becomes music, and they become excited and inspired, and then they can actually compose some music. Mm-hmm. And I simply leave it to, you know, and I trust... You know, Pat Carpenter said, well, these guys write, think like this. So some of the students will be good and they will think like this and the music will naturally have organic unity. I think that my situation musically is a very peculiar one in the history of music. You know, I think that this level of consciousness can easily turn into a level of self-consciousness. Mm. And, but it's also... to know all this stuff historically doesn't necessarily mean that you're relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got to get them to do music that's relevant to themselves in order to get them to compose it all. You know, and I've had students come in, like teaching species counterpoint. It's fascinating. Because some people come in and they can handle the idea, okay, this is the problem. Here's the little collection of stuff, and this is the problem, and you solve the problem. Right, and then eventually we'll get to some music by this process of learning to solve these problems. Some people come in and they just can't get wrapped their mind around the idea that it's a problem at all, and they're like, they just go home and they just write some notes that they think sound okay and come back, and then you try to explain to them, well, there's this rule, and they just totally don't understand what that's about. What does that mean?
What is the current language in music? Where are we at here?
Oh, Lordy. I think that I think that it only seems like there is a singular musical language from within a particular cultural framework, and that in this day and age, because of the widespread amount of information, people have to work very hard to deny the existence of things outside of their cultural framework in order to keep the problems that they're dealing with musically simple enough for them to do it in the more natural way that it would have occurred prior to that amount of information being available. So I think that there's a lot of, you know, hence it's not enough to just play the chunka-chunka swing guitar stuff. You have to have the haircut and the suit.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to, like, stop... and you have to... And then we get into this situation where musical styles... amongst the musicians are defined like where it's not just enough to like this music, you must also not like these other musics in order to show that you're a true practitioner of this particular thing. And so there's this and then there's these other weird characters who float around outside of those worlds.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
like, we give me an example.
Like you. Like me.
Uh-huh.
You know? Well, it's like you go and you play a klezmer gig, and... but the fact that you like klezmer doesn't mean that you hate Charlie Parker.
You're right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I imagine for some klezmer people out there somewhere, there's probably some klezmer people who, you know, you're not supposed to listen to that Charlie Parker or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you do, it's like, it doesn't have anything to do with the music that you're making when you're making... It doesn't have anything to do with being klezmer music. So you don't pay any attention to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly see this amongst the young jazz people, where it's not enough to merely like Charlie Christian; you have to also hate Keith Richards.
Right.
You know, so there's a tremendous, there's this other level to the thing where it's not just about being in a part of your culture and being happy, productive member of your musical culture, but you also have to be desperately fixing the hole in the roof to keep the rain from coming in, because there's that outside information that's seeping in that you're not supposed to admit. And I find this in all kinds of cases. If I go into the classical musical world, and you know, they will not even hardly acknowledge the existence of all pop music. Mm-hmm. And if you go into the jazz world, they don't acknowledge. You have these guys in the jazz world who are like, the great thing about jazz is it's so complex. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, you know, there's this other music by these guys, you know, Schoenberg and a bunch of people after that. You know, it's really complex. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to know. You know, they've got to keep that information away from them, lest it disturb their sleepwalking.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
That's, I think, the sort of the condition. I think that holds across the board. I mean, if you go up to, you know, if you go to any particular university, they're going to have their criteria for what is the stuff that you deny. And if you go to any culture, they're probably going to have their criteria for what is the stuff that you deny. And I'm trying to figure out first of all, I find that it's not necessary to deny anything, because you can, you know, if you can do the job, you can do the gig.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are, you know, there is a class of musicians who are very professional, who do all kinds of different things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, call them up for this kind of a gig, and they're, you know, they can do it. Like Brazilian, yeah, okay, I got that. I worked on that. You know, they immerse themselves, and cool. And you call them for the klezmer gig, and they'll immerse themselves, and they can do the klezmer gig.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's a range of these people who are, you know, professionals at that level. And they kind of float around the outside of this other class of musicians who really just do the one thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also, you know, the other thing is that music is the expression of a culture. Mm-hmm. And so there's like, well, which culture are you expressing with this particular piece? That is, who's, I find it's that, you know, Schoenberg would talk about the piece as the letter to whom it may concern.
Uh-huh.
And I think but I do think that he still lived within a more unified notion of what, like, that he thought of all of humanity as being a single culture ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not so sure that I have that luxury.
It's hard. It's so confusing to tell whether that was our sense of global, or whether that was just because the Austro-Hungarian Empire had been so big and powerful, and was it?
Well, you know, they weren't really that big and powerful. That's the funny part. That's what cracked me up about the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Because, you know, frankly, during that whole time, the British were much more powerful and widespread than the Austro. In a pretty isolated little scene there, but they actually thought of themselves as the complete universe.
It's true, but, you know, now when we think of the term global, we think it's something that we can fly in two flights. And you know...
Well, here's a thought. You know, here's an interesting thought. Vienna.
Yeah.
I mean, Vienna just was dripping. It was like New Orleans. It was just dripping music, right?
Uh-huh.
From dripping it off the trees. Whether you liked it or not, you know, it was there. I mean, it's like, it wasn't just the big guys.
Uh-huh.
You know, I remember going to a Horiger in Vienna. And we went to go to a Horiger that was in the house that Beethoven had lived in.
Uh-huh.
But that one wasn't open when we went there.
Uh-huh.
But the one just down the street that had been there since Beethoven had lived there was still there.
What's a Horiger?
A Horiger, it's like a little wine bar.
Okay.
It's kind of a wine bar, and they also have like kind of cold cuts and snacks and things, mm-hmm. and they have music, you know. It's a little bar kind of a scene. And, you know, so we go to the Horiger, and there's the guys, and there's a guy playing accordion, and a guy playing violin, and a guy playing bass, and they're playing, you know, kind of Viennese stuff. You know, of all kinds of different things. And I'm sitting there thinking, this place was probably here with guys like that when Beethoven was here.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And when you come from a city like that, there's this other thing that happens because... And I see it here, too. And I find it... I love it. And, you know, it's like... It's like Kermit not knowing who the Rolling Stones are.
Mm-hmm.
Why should he?
Yeah.
You know, that happens out there somewhere.
Yeah.
We're here in New Orleans, you know, mm-hmm. where we totally understand, you know, so when I hear Dumpster Funk,
mm-hmm.
it's like, I totally understand where that's coming from, because it's really New Orleans thing, mm-hmm. and the music here is, there's so much of it that you can just become immersed in it, and it's got all these different aspects and corners and angles to it, and you just have to make the gig.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing about that, also the delightful thing about the particular culture here is, as you've seen, that the authentic original culture is very open.
Mm.
You know, that is to say, most of the really, you know, great cats who are playing here are not kind of closed-minded people. If you bring in a new sound and they see it and it strikes their fancy, yeah, they'll go with that.
I'm not sure. I mean, yeah, definitely it's a lot better than it was, but it's still pretty tribalized down here. I mean, you know, like you're talking about the haircuts and stuff like that. And
well, I mean, I'm talking about the black.
No, the black white thing, the old one, yeah, okay.
Yeah, the older black culture, you know.
Yeah, because I mean, it's...
I mean, if I'm talking about the world in which Jun Yamaguchi can work here and wind up as the guitar player for the Wild Magnolias, because
they're very open.
Because he can rip, and you know, and they get out live on the gig, or where Tim Green can go out and play with, what's his name, the blues great Gatemouth Brown, and Gatemouth, you know, doesn't necessarily like the way he plays, but he can see that the audience responds to it, and so it's fine.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And so there was, you know, and that was a very exciting world when I first got here. Is, you know, that was the tail end, I guess, of what was going on. But, you know,
yeah,
I mean, I got here and I was playing the Sun Ra stuff and nobody was batting an eye, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, people here really were into it. I mean, the people here at that, well, there was an idea of interesting alternative music, and people still had the hunger that they needed to go and check out, see what it was, see what this thing is, see what people are doing. I'm not sure that's going on now, but you're working. What are your ideas now? What are you thinking about now? What
okay.
goes on?
Okay, what am I thinking about now? On the one hand, I'm thinking about writing songs that are the kinds of things that come out of the earth. It's hard for me to put. I try to songs in some cases that are very simple, maybe sometimes they're more complex, but where they kind of unfold for me. I almost don't feel like I'm actually in control of them when I'm writing them.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, when I'm writing more complex music, a couple of things I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about beginnings, middles, and ends. So I'm thinking about kind of phrase structure, and I'm also thinking about creating a kind of internal unity to the line through a developing variation. It's the Pat Carpenter's old thing that something changes, something stays the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so using motivic development, but using that motivic development in a way to articulate more complex ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I'm thinking about, and I've been using a little bit, is, and this comes more, I'm fascinated by techno music and by not just techno music in general, but like by DJs, and I'm thinking about the ways that the technology we can use to manipulate the materials, but I'm also thinking about the ways that suggests for new kinds of organization. So I'm interested in cutting and splicing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, something that I'll do is I'll create a complex passage out of some kind of 12-tone counterpoint contrapuntal situation.
Mm-hmm.
With a very complex, you know, kind of rhythmic scheme. And then I'll take a chunk of that and turn it into an ostinato by cutting and pasting, mm-hmm. and then developing from that ostinato.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm interested in this new way of using repetition that's given by the technology That is to say that you could take a, it's like sampling, taking a sample from the piece that you're writing, mm-hmm. and then using that sample from the piece that you're writing as the basis for another section. Mm-hmm. So I would go back after writing a passage and look for cool little parts that I can pull out and use as that. And one of the things that here is to kind of, sometimes they happen, the cool parts happen because they go across the break mm-hmm. of the phrase structure. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of creates a new kind of thing. Those are some of the things that I'm dealing with in my composing.
Mm-hmm. And so,
pitch wise, I'm using a language that, it's similar to the language, I guess, of Piero Lunaire, mm-hmm. which is to say that motivic shapes can be manipulated in very skewed ways. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like taking the musical material and putting it into a kaleidoscope to create a new image.